dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
as we you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, I'm going to bring you a seminar conducted by Charles Eisenstein, the author of The Ascent of Humanity. It's on de-schooling. It deals with identifying the ways of thinking and behaving, in other words, the social conditioning, inculcated by the schooling process, in order that we can make these conscious and engage in our own mental liberation. I've played a variety of speakers over the years discussing studies that reveal how dissatisfied most people are with their lives. And of course, you can look around and probably draw those same conclusions. Yet though so many are dissatisfied, most submit to perpetuating the very things they don't like. I'm always asking why. Because no society, even the most totalitarian, can persist if some critical mass of people within it refuses to comply. The seminar we're going to hear has participation from the audience throughout it, and unfortunately, some of that is inaudible. I've done the best I can with it. I nevertheless found it interesting and worthwhile, so I hope that you will also. Here's Charles Eisenstein.
I'm going to talk about de-schooling yourself, releasing the unconscious habits of school. Because a lot of us are pioneering new ways of learning, teaching, education, and new ways of relating between adults and children. I mean, that's really the most general formulation of school. A way for children and adults to relate. And we're trying to do it in a new way. And a lot of us have an intellectual understanding of what that is. We may not all agree on it exactly, but we have an intellectual understanding of what we want to do and what we don't want to do. But sometimes I've noticed, at least in my own experience with this, that I have unconscious habits, unconscious ways of being, thinking, and speaking that perpetuate the old system, even though in my mind I believe myself committed to something new. So I'm thinking about the new but still living in the old. And these habits of thinking, speaking, and being have gradually come to light for me over a period of years. And I expect that there's still many ways in which I'm still very much a schoolboy or a schooled boy, and that there are many ways that I'm still in the process of discovering or still yet to discover. So I'm hoping that some of these will come to light for me in this workshop today. And perhaps all of you, too, some of you might have awakened to your own internalized schooling in different ways than I have. And so maybe some of what comes out here will be new for you also, because we all really, I think, in pioneering this new age, we need help from each other, from other pioneers, as we explore the invisible paths of the new world. Now, the things that I'm about to talk about, the habits of school, they're not just of school. They're not, if even if you were homeschooled or unschooled or went to a free school, you're probably still not completely free of them because they permeate our civilization. They permeate our culture and our civilization on a very deep level. School isn't something separate from the rest of the grand enterprise of social engineering.
World domination.
Yeah, of world domination. It fits in as an integral part of the system that we've created. It is an intensification of trends of management and control that have been going on for thousands of years. So it's not just, what we're going to talk about isn't just what happens in school, and if you didn't go to school, you'll be free of it, but it's something that school is especially designed to drill in to our habits of being. And a lot of what happens in school, we internalize as adults. The ways that we related to teacher and to parents, of course, but that's not what this particular seminar is about, but the ways that we relate to teacher and to authority in general. I mean, school is really our first experience of an authority outside the family. And so the way that we relate to this authority, eventually we grow up and we relate the same way to an internalized teacher, an internalized authority. And we no longer need the external controls, the external rewards and incentives and punishments and threats. When that happens, we are considered educated. We are considered mature. Matures, and we get a document to certify that we have learned the lessons of school, that we have internalized these programs that are now of self-control, and we can be counted on to be compliant. That certificate is called a degree. And if you want to prove your exceptional submissiveness and compliance, then you can get a graduate degree or a PhD. Okay, so without any further ado, I'd like to just begin a big list of the habits of school, the unconscious, well, for some of you it'll be unconscious, for some of us conscious, for most of us probably half conscious. But the habits of school, things that you learn in school. I'm just going to start off the list with a few examples. For example, here's one that's very apropos, the current setting, being on time. Okay?
Punctuality.
Right. Punctuality, being on time. Okay, or more generally, being on a schedule. Oh, and by the way, though, almost every habit of compliance that we learn in school has a mirror image, okay, which would be a reflexive rejection of it. Defiance. There's habits of submission and habits of defiance. So the habit of defiance would be being defiantly late all the time. Because, you know, you gotta one way that rebellion, like reflexive automatic rebellion, is itself a habit of slavery. Okay, so this would be being on time, never on time. Okay, another example is dutifully doing your assignments, being dutiful. Boy, it's just not dutiful and industrious in the work assigned to you. Okay, and then another habit of school would be laziness, which is a natural quality of slaves and people who have been slaves. If you can't rebel outright, if that is futile, then you rebel by pretending to be lazy and stupid. Hence, a lot of I mean, that's what people believed of the African Americans. They believed that, well, they're lazy and stupid. But that was really a form of unconscious rebellion when overt rebellion was a little bit too dangerous. And that's what some of us do in school, too. We pretend to be lazy and stupid so we can get out of doing things that we don't really want to do. Okay, so then lazy. Okay, and so I just want to open it up, call out some habits of school.
Getting permission.
Getting permission. Yep. Yeah. Yep. Raising your hand. I knew that was going to come up. You know what? I'm just going to give up this board. Well, it's so nice to see them all here, but...
Do you want to write it?
Yeah, can someone else write it? That's a good idea.
Chair, maybe?
Right, so getting permission. That's halfway written. Good. Staying in your seat.
With feet on the ground.
Feet on the ground. Okay, good.
As I'm not doing it right now. The defiance.
Yeah. Just call them out, yeah.
Visual appearance.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, again, this isn't something that is completely restricted to school, but it's the crucible for learning to appear acceptable. Yeah.
That you need other people to tell you what you need to know.
Okay, right. Telling. Learning by being told.
Being led.
Intellectual dependence.
Okay, being led.
Yeah.
Being led. Okay.
As opposed to dependence on authority, reflexive distrust of authority.
Yes, absolutely.
It's like the negative of the authority, having the authority.
Right, reflexive distrust of authority. I mean, maybe in this world there is a proper place for authority. But if authority is abused, then a child naturally will, some children will be cowed. Other children will be defiant and distrust all authority, even if it's not improperly exercised. And this could be a philosophical conversation about, is there ever a place for authority or leadership being led, right? But that's not what it's about right now. Right now, we're just going to talk about the habitual aspect of it.
Someone once described me as having in his situation where I was working in school, as having me against the world attitude.
Mm-hmm. Amen to that, sister.
A certain amount of, and I think that comes from having had to defend myself against the school situation where I was not okay.
Right.
But that defending doesn't, now I'm an adult, do I need those defense mechanisms anymore?
Right. Yep. I'd like to add one. Wanting credit for being right.
Say it again.
Wanting credit for being right. Or just wanting to be right. Wanting to be acknowledged as right.
Just credit or something specific, like a tangible reward.
Acknowledgement for being right.
So along with that, relying on somebody else to assess, performance.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Rankings.
Right, rankings. Measuring up. How about measuring up? Do I measure up? Because in school, you constantly are externally evaluated about whether you measure up, whether you make the standard. Even more now, of course, with No Child Left Behind than when I was a kid. But do I measure up? Do I measure up? The internalization of the external standards is, right, does this child measure up? Is the external aspect of it, when it gets internalized and becomes a habit, do I measure up? Okay, and is anyone doing it right now? Notice right now what habits of school are operating. For example, are you evaluating whether you have these habits and giving yourself credit if you don't have them? And if you do have them, I flunked. Okay, and so we can see how deep this goes and the freedom that is available when we no longer are in the habits of school. Any others?
Point.
Yeah.
You're giving me this gold star.
Right.
So it sets up the situation for that kind of transaction.
Yes. Now, how would I respond to that in a way that doesn't reinforce the habits of schooling? Well, as the person who's facilitating this workshop, how can I right now act outside the habits of school and act to not reinforce them?
You can talk on a very neutral thing, like that could be the philosophy for some people or not people.
Yeah.
It gets all very moving.
But that's not how I would do it. I'd say that's exciting for me. I'd say that point, I feel excited about that point. And
Don't you think that's still kind of the same? I mean, people get a rev when they get
excited. You could still, I mean, you can take anything and feed it through your own school filter, right? Teacher getting excited, you can say, well, that counts as praise. And now Charles likes me because I made this point that he feels excited about. And so wanting to be liked by authority. Competition. Mm-hmm. Competition, definitely a habit of school. Yes.
Manipulation. By overt and covert means.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, right, because kids are always trying to manipulate the teacher. It's a constant program. When I was teaching, this came up a lot when I was teaching at Penn State. I taught there for 4 years a while ago. And it was very rare, at least for the first part of the semester, that anyone was genuine. Because there was this, you know, kind of background program of, let's make the professor like me so I'll get a good grade. Let's make him think highly of me. Let's act in a way that shows that I'm smart. Okay, so publicly being smart, I would put onto the list. Wanting to be seen as smart. I notice that a lot in, sometimes live things, but also especially email forums of various sorts, where sometimes it seems like, you know, everyone is just competing to be publicly seen as smart and right.
If you've ever seen, there's a shirt that says, somebody is wrong on the internet.
yeah.
To that dynamic.
Yeah.
It strikes me that all of these characteristics are just as true with regard to how the administration treats the staff as staff treats students.
Yeah.
So it's inclusive. It's
yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and business too. And like offices.
Being dependent.
Being dependent.
All of these are like
Yep. Everything on Gatto's list of the seven lessons of school is very deeply woven into this. Yes.
Wanting to appear too key.
Yeah.
What's that?
That's right. Yes. That's a good one. I hadn't thought of that one. Yeah, not wanting to appear too keen. Right. You know, the other kids will make fun of you if you like learning too much. Yeah. So cynicism. You know, not really believing fully in anything and not being too enthusiastic.
And self-censorship. So you don't think too far outside the box.
Mm-hmm. Self-censorship, yep, because you could get shot down. Mm-hmm.
Not wanting to or being afraid to ask for help. Or kind of reflexive independence.
Yes. Right, it could go both ways. There's the dependency that a couple people have mentioned, intellectual dependency, you know, looking outside for the answers, and then the on the other side is I'm going to go it alone, I'm not going to get answers from anybody else, I'm going to do it myself. Which is, again, not always appropriate or possible in this world. Both of these habits keep us small.
Right versus wrong dichotomy.
Mm-hmm. Dichotomous right and wrong. Definitely something we learn in school. Yeah, repressing emotions. In the classroom and in the academic world in general, I mean, you're not supposed to get emotional if you... If you try to publish something in an academic journal, you know, it's not supposed to be emotional, it's supposed to be objective. So this is definitely a habit of suppressing emotions and suppressing subjectivity.
And intuition.
Suppressing intuition because you have to have a reason. You have to be able to produce a reason for things. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Were you saying about religion, like excising it from?
No.
Oh, okay. Hmm. So how can you sum that up in like three words? adhering to higher values. Okay. Kind of, okay. I'm trying to think how that would be in public school, but there is kind of like this...
The state and the government. And...
Right. Civics being a good citizen and a productive member of society and that kind of stuff.
Pledge allegiance.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes.
Labeling.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, labeling. And related to that, labeling knowledge and dividing the world into subjects. Okay, so in school, you know, you go from whatever, social studies to math to English to this to that.
Disintegration.
And then in life, it's like, well, I have different compartments of my life. I have my relationship, you know, I have my work, you know, I have my hobbies, I have this, I have that. This compartmentalized life. This kind of fragmentation perhaps didn't exist 10,000 years ago.
And then related to that, mendacity, institutionalized lying, lack of honesty on the part of individuals permeates the whole thing.
Okay, give me a concrete example. Yeah.
Like when the bureaucracy, you're working with people and nobody wants to work. Step up above it because it makes everybody else look bad. Whenever you get slack for doing putting your full effort in, because then everybody else is going to look bad for not putting their full effort in.
Yeah.
Maybe not a perfect.
From high levels of organizations, they will make pronouncements that after a while everybody starts to recognize that it's never the truth.
Yes.
And
but yet you just go with it anyway.
Yes. Right. So there's kind of this acceptable, there's this realm of acceptable discourse, acceptable questions, acceptable answers, acceptable opinions that everybody knows is not true. This is ubiquitous in our culture. Habitual and semi-conscious mendacity, as you put it, from everything from, you know, you drive around and look at the subdivision names, you know. Walnut Crossing. There are no walnut trees, and nor is there a crossing. Maybe they cut them down to build it, but often there weren't even any to begin with, you know. Aspen Heights. No aspen trees there, and it's not even a Heights, you know. It just sounded kind of British, you know, so they decided to name it that.
Martin Luther King Jr. School is a totally segregated school.
Mm-hmm. Right. So invoking these symbols that have no necessary connection to reality. And we're so habituated to this that when politicians lie, we think nothing of it. Maybe some of you guys are exceptions, but people are not really shocked when, for example, this was a while ago, but George Bush, the elder, supposedly saw Independence Day, this movie that was kind of patriotic, and then... a statement was issued about his opinions about the movie and how much he liked it. But this statement was written before he'd actually seen it by somebody else. And everybody in the press knew that. But nobody called him on it, and nobody really cared, and it just went out there as into the... You know, and it's not just Republicans who do this.
I want to add up there, feeling unsafe.
Feeling unsafe. Mm-hmm.
That affects, like,
right.
Why media, that's one of the reasons media might not stand up, is, you know, am I safe if I don't? Is it safe to speak up? Is it safe to
right.
cry?
Playing it safe, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, it's an emotional place.
Right, playing it safe. And okay, here's one of these unconscious habits that really was powerful in me, okay, to make it personal. Like, I found that before I said anything, I would first calculate whether I would get approval and whether it was safe, whether it was acceptable given the role that I occupied in this big class, You know, there's different roles and different people can say different things. But I would have this kind of program running that would calculate everything based on how is somebody going to see me and how is somebody going to react to me if I say it this way. So I was not comfortable ever, and not feeling free to just be myself and, put myself out there, and if you don't like it, too bad. That's something you do not learn in school.
Something that I've been working with for a few years is really valuing non-thinking work as a working person. You know, I worked in an office for a number of years, and I felt like, well, I'm good, I'm important, I'm all this stuff, and I'm, you know, people are good, but I'm sort of like better, or sort of like, you know, and now I've not done that, and now I'm struggling, well, I'm just as good as everybody. I'm having this real shift in, like, perspective on, and it really has to do with, well, school, education, you know, being smart and having a lot of knowledge is really valuable. And not showing or using that knowledge is, you know, my place is very different. I feel, you know, schooling is really, really so valuable, and not having schooling or not using, you know, higher education in your work or in your life, then you're not quite as valuable or worth it. You know, I'm seeing both, or been in both places. Wow, this is really impressive how strong that. Mm-hmm. It really is about school. Like, well, I got there. I'm just as good as everybody else. Or, you know,
yeah.
This whole thing that really sets, you know, school sets that up.
In terms of the habit, that it's the habit of being out of your body and in yourself and your
perspective. Right. That more broadly, it's a habit of disassociation, and that's a natural consequence of evaluation, because to evaluate something, including yourself, you do have to step outside, which can be good, perhaps, when you do it consciously with intention. But when it becomes a habit, then you become disassociated from yourself, out of touch with your passions, your desires, your feelings, which is considered a good thing. Because how can you have a society where people do things that are degrading to human capacities or insulting to human nobility if you are in touch with your feelings and passions? You won't have people pushing mops all day or lying to customers all day or building weapons all day, probably.
So schools foster celebrity.
Pardon me?
They foster celebrity. They teach that, you know, you're valuable if you're a celebrity for some reason. They teach the famous people in classes and talk about the people who turn the wheels of society and make sure jobs are done.
Yeah.
The importance of that contribution.
Yeah.
It's also in the school structure. In that, you know, the kids that are getting the great grades, the kids that are the great athletes, the ones, those are the
sports stars.
Those are, there's always that in the culture.
And the folks in the shop doing the tech stuff in the shop, all those, you know. I grew up with that, and, you know, it's just fear is really hard to really value all of people.
Yeah. To me, that's a big one. For me, like the things that they teach explicitly, like about the great explorers and the great heroes and the movers and shakers, I think that's probably only about 5% of where we get the habits of school. The received ideology is less important than just the ways of doing things that are so routine that we think that that's just the way things are done. But one basic one is, what's my assignment? And we internalize that so deeply that people are very uncomfortable if there is no list of instructions here. Here's what you are to do. When I was teaching at Penn State, again, like if I gave an assignment and they're like, well, how many pages do you want us to write? And if I said, however long it takes to do it to your satisfaction, people were extremely uncomfortable with that because they've been habituated to fulfilling some requirements, because you fulfill some requirements and you get your reward. And if there is no list of requirements to fulfill, it's disorienting. And so what kind of job and what kind of life is that a kind of training for? Obviously. Quantity over quality. Or you could say fulfilling the letter of the requirements.
Not the intent or not.
Yeah, although a lot of times the intent is that you fulfill the letter of the requirements.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think those are two different things. It really is a thing about quantity over quality.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a different thing.
More pages counts more, despite whatever the quality is.
Right.
The approach.
Right. But more basically, it's just, you know, this desire to be told what to do. And then the opposite of it, of course, is hostility, unthinking hostility to ever being told what to do. But you know what? Like, sometimes we need to be told what to do. At least that's what I've discovered in my... that's not good. That's what I've discovered in my life, is that sometimes I truly need something from the outside. Mm-hmm. Disregard for integrity or higher principles in favor of rules and procedures. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah. That's a good question. Integrity makes a lot of sense to me. Higher principles sounds suspect. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Someone's reality is better than someone else's. This is, get with the program. This, to do it through an act of will, then he does somebody who naturally, and what school valorizes is mental activity, because there you are, your body is bound, you're sitting at a desk, and this is good. And this, very deeply ingrained.
I was going to say, kind of go along with that. Before you go into school, we're always told, share. When we hit the school, it's keep your eye on your own paper. Don't share your answers. Don't tell your other person over here. It's kind of told just the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you go to work, you'll be evaluated on teamwork.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fear of taking risks or making mistakes.
I wanted to raise fear as a big issue. Fear underlying everything. I can't even gauge how comprehensive it is.
Yes, that is one of the big ones. Because how do you make somebody do something that they don't want to do? Like, what do we mean when you say, well, you know, the teacher made me do it, or somebody made me do it? Like, what does that really mean? Because it's tied up in fear, and if school is about anything, if you read the historical stuff that Gatto and other people write, you know, that school developed basically in order to train people from a young age to do things that they didn't want to do, because nobody wanted to work on an assembly line for 12 hours a day, or, you know, add up columns of figures like Industrial Revolution clerks had to do, you know. No one wanted to do that kind of work, especially if they had been a farmer or a craftsperson doing general things that were creative and interesting. No one wanted to do that, and so people had bad work habits, and so they said, well, we're going to have to train people from a young age to do things for external rewards that they don't actually want to do, that are tedious and degrading, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? Most people probably understand that narrative of how school developed in the Industrial Revolution as part and parcel of that enterprise to break the spirit to do things that are of the machine. So, how do you make somebody do something? Well, if someone is pointing a gun to my head and says, you know, do that, then I could rightly say that they made me do that, because if I didn't do it, they would kill me. I mean, in some sense, maybe even then, they can't make me do it. But
you always do it because you decide to do it. No one can make you do anything. Like at the end of the day, if somebody has a gun to your head, you still made the choice.
That's right. Right, and that's really important, because on a deep level, to free ourselves from the habits of school, which are the habits of civilization, we need to no longer be afraid to die. We have to, at some point, and this will happen to everybody, you'll come to some point in your life where you say, you know what, I'm going to do whatever it is. I'm going to, and it could be something, you know, I'm going to quit this job. I'm going to start this school. I'm going to jump out into this endeavor, which is risky, and I'm going to do it no matter what, even though I'm going to lose my health insurance, even though I'm going to take a cut in income, even though I might not be able to pay my mortgage, even though all of these scary things come up. And basically you're saying it's more important to live right than it is to stay alive. Life is more important than survival, is another way to put it, to be fully alive and fully human and to be here for the purpose that you were here for. And so at some point in this de-schooling process, you come up against fear of what is going to happen. This is instilled in us in school when they say, you know, you better do your homework and get good grades or it's going to go on your permanent record. I mean, this is what I got in 10th grade. You know, this is for real now. You know, in 7th and 8th grade, that wasn't on your permanent record. But now colleges are going to be looking at this. They're going to look at your GPA. And if you don't go to good college, you're not going to get a good job, you know, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so you start early. And then in 7th grade, they were already saying, you know, we're not going to coddle you like we did in elementary school. You know, this is going to determine whether you get into the AP classes in high school. I mean, this inculcating of fear goes back very far. So living in fear is a habit of school. One way, and a lot of stuff's coming through here, and I just want to just finish off this thought, and then we'll have more comments. I will invite comments now, and then I'll give you the second part soon. Yeah, talk louder so we can pick it up on that.
Just the idea of promoting security and the fear that results from not achieving that security and success.
Yeah.
If you don't go to college, you know, you'll never get a job.
Right. Right. Yeah, Alan Watts had some insights about that. And so what you do is you take away this primal security, then you give back a conditional security and threaten to take it away in order to control somebody. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You first and then you.
Up on the line.
That is related to some of the things we were talking about. But one thing that reminds me of, and maybe it's the same thing that you're saying, is that in school, one of the things that we learn is that you have to start with the elements, the basics, the fundamentals, and you build up from that. So in order to learn organic chemistry, first you have to learn, you know, about electron valences, you know, and then you have to, and you build it up into bigger and bigger molecules. And if you want to learn physics, if you want to learn, you know, Einsteinian physics, first you have to learn, you know, the equations for force, you know, and for acceleration, and you build up from that. But as a matter of fact, that's not actually how people learn. Usually you start with the higher level questions, and then you say, okay, now in order to understand this, then you go lower and lower and lower, and you get to the elements from these higher level questions, and that's historically how it evolved too. You know, people didn't start with the basics. And one effect of, and so many textbooks say elements of this, elements of that, elements of algebra, elements of political theory. And one of the effects, though, of doing it from the top, from the bottom up, and like you said, to try to build knowledge, is that knowledge and learning is very boring. At the base level, it's very boring. And the real questions, the real interesting stuff is inaccessible to anyone who hasn't gone through this really long process. So knowledge becomes a realm of experts. And that feeds into another of the things, the unconscious habits of schooling. Well, if that's the case, then the experts will have to tell me what's true.
Alienation from learning.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, alienation from learning.
Knowledge is established and fixed.
Yes.
And you just learn about what other people figured
right.
out.
Right. And perhaps you can, if you build up from these basic building blocks and finally finish grad school, then you too can be in the rarefied realm of real science and real knowledge, and you can make an infinitesimal contribution to it.
In thinking about this, I've been kind of like running like a chicken and egg kind of question in my head, because I'm feeling like I can't just jump and say that like the source of all these habits is in fact school, and I think it's like reductive to say like there's some sort of time before or there's something like that, because you mentioned it, you said these are like the habits of civilization. So for me, like in recognizing these things in myself and having gone through public school and trying to understand what these things are in myself, but then also seeing them in other aspects of the world and in offices and in, you know, situations that don't even have anything to do with school, I wonder, you know, I just want to throw that question out in terms of what is it about maybe the human condition or human, you know, beings that leads us towards these types of things. So I think, like with Alan Watts and kind of the wisdom of insecurity, there's something about a yearning that people have towards fixed and secure, and it's so much easier to have somebody telling you what your structure of your day is or telling, you know, like that. And so if we're talking about, because we're, you know, talking, framing this in the sense of de-schooling ourselves, basically, so
yeah,
what we're talking about is then de-schooling civilization, but we live in civilization. So how does that,
right,
you know, how do we put that out there? And that's a big, like, that's the question I've just run through my head. I'm like, I see a lot of, you know, reason why all these things exist in school or why they perpetuate and things like that. So how do we even begin to de-school ourselves if civilization in itself? And I mean, I don't know, we don't have any really record of you know, what primitive man's social structures were like. So it's hard to just imagine what it was, that there was some time when it wasn't existed.
Okay, this is completely what my book is about. My book is called The Ascent of Humanity. It's a semi-ironic title. But that's the question that I spent half my adult life thinking about. The answer that I came to that was satisfying for me is that the origin of all of this stuff is as deep as it could possibly be. It's the human sense of self. All of this comes from a belief and a felt experience that to be... Well, let's do it, actually. Here. Let's do a little experiment, okay? Close your eyes, and I would like you to make a picture of yourself doing nothing but simply being. And I want you to experience yourself as just being. I want you to make a picture of yourself doing nothing but being, but existing. What does that look like to just exist? Okay, open your eyes. In the second part, we'll do a felt experience of just being to show why the picture that most people have of just being is a trick that's been perpetrated on us. How many people imagine yourself alone? Imagine yourself, your picture of you just being was a picture of you alone. Okay. Most people imagine themselves alone. If I say, well, do you know, imagine yourself doing nothing but just existing.
Like that's what I'm doing right now.
What are you doing right now?
Being.
Yeah, you are, and you're not alone.
Yeah.
But you could say, well, you're in a seminar, right? Or you're talking to somebody, so you're not just being. I don't believe that logic, but I'm saying that's what someone might say.
Okay.
Right? Someone might say that, you know, if you're not interacting with somebody, that's not just being. But there's this pure state of existence. So to be is to be alone. So at the foundation of our civilization and of our educational system, both, is a human sense of self that is separate and discrete. Like starts and ends here. It's what Alan Watts called the skin-encapsulated ego. It's what biology calls the phenotype, the expression of the nuclear DNA. It's what religion would call something like the soul encased in flesh and separate from other souls. It's what economics calls the economic man, the rational actor. Okay, and so in all of these systems, you have these separate units that have relationships and interact, but they're fundamentally separate. Ancient people did not think this way. And Stone Age people, tribal people to this day, don't really think this way. To be, to them, is to relate. And if you strip away your relationships, you are less. that's what's happened through our ideology and partly through our schooling, is that our connected self has been truncated and we've been made small. This creates a very painful wound, which is why it hurts just to be, a state which we call boredom, which is a new state. Indigenous people did not have a word for boredom because it didn't exist for them. They were happy to literally sit and watch the grass grow. And so much comes from this separation. Part of it is the ideology of objectivity, that we're separate from the universe, too. So I'm not going to go too much more into that, but if you want to... What?
When you ask me to do that,
yes.
I think of myself doing nothing as being.
Yeah.
The interesting thing happened. I could not think of my body.
Uh-huh.
I was there in my thoughts, but not in body. What I thought of was just blue sky. So then when you now talking about objectivity, I think it's if you stretch that idea of associating with others and thinking of yourself as just not you but the rest of the people as well, stretch that more, it gets you to what I mean. Scientifically speaking, there is a quark in your body and a quark in that chair are identical. There is really no difference between the two. So we're building these boxes more and more, bringing it down to physical
right.
state.
There's some deep metaphysical issues here that I won't go into too much, except in one small way, which will be relevant, although maybe not so much to schooling. But there's really two ways to look at it. Like, you could say that, okay, the orthodox ideology says that every electron in the universe is identical. That there are many, many, many of them, and they're all identical. That every carbon atom in the universe, well, every carbon-12 atom is identical, and every carbon-14 atom is identical, and every building block is identical, and therefore that we are basically just permutations of the same basic building blocks, and we're not fundamentally different. There's nothing unique about us. It's just that we're different mixes of the same stuff. And that's one of the ideologies underneath school, which basically treats people as variations on the same identical template and tries to use, therefore, standard methods to educate us to get a standard result. There are two ways to look at it that are alternatives to this. One, and these both have physics justifications. One is that every electron is unique, which is why when you send them through a diffraction slit, some of them decide to go this way and some decide to go that way, and there's no reductionistic reason to explain why. And the animist, the tribalist, would say, it's obvious why one goes this way and one goes that way, because that one chose to go this way and that one chose to go that way, and they each have a uniqueness. They each have a personhood, a sentience. When you apply this to school, then you get everything that this conference is all about, because fundamentally we say that every child is unique and self-determined, and has a right to be self-determined. The other way to look at it that's equally true is that there is only one electron. There is only one electron. Every electron is the same electron, not identical, not separate electrons that are identical, but the same electron coming in and out of existence, looping back through time, and that we are all therefore the same being, looking at each other through different eyes. And you can get a felt sense of that. And the joy and the relief and the connection and the intimacy is so intense that we just have to look away in half a second, either with our eyes or with our mind. Okay, I want to, let's see.
Can I ask, when Dave asked that question, what was running through my mind? And you were talking about, what's this perspective of what people were doing thousands of years ago? It seems that a lot of learning must have come from nature, mm-hmm. right, and watching. And
you know, animals killing each other and, you know, just this whole idea of, you know, survival of the fittest to some degree.
Yeah.
Helped manifest that fear in one way and helped manifest this idea that, you know, you do have to exercise smarts in some way to move forward.
Yes. The analytic method and the ego self and the fear-based self does have a proper role. I mean, there is knowledge that you can gain by taking something apart and dividing it up into little pieces and doing all the things that we do in our educational system. But what's happened is that that particular way of approaching knowledge and approaching being has become, we've over-applied it and tried to apply it to everything, including things where it does not apply. And that's why categorically rejecting it is itself a habit of schooling, right? It's one of the ones on this side, if we had maintained that. But for those of you who came in late, to reflexively and unthinkingly reject something is just as much a habit of that thing as to unthinkingly accept it. And to be free of it is to take it on its own merits and use it appropriately. I think I'll conclude this hour with one more observation about fear. Because I asked the question, how do you make somebody do something, and talked about putting a gun to your head. The greatest fear of any young mammal is abandonment. It's a death sentence for a young mammal who's nursing. So if you want to control a child, the most powerful way is to tap into the fear of abandonment, which is the fear of death. And the way to do that is through conditional acceptance and rejection. Acceptance says, I won't abandon you, you're here. Rejection says, I might abandon you. You're on thin ice, and if you keep doing this, you know, I'm going to push you out of the nest. I think birds have the same fear. And so this is how parents control their kids, and this is how teachers in schools control children too. Grades and red stars and check marks and all of this, these are emblems of acceptance and rejection, and they tap into the primal fear of a young mammal. And then we internalize it as guilt and shame. The label of good, I was a good boy today, or bad, what's wrong with you? This is the internalized program of control that we learn through our childhood and through school. And it doesn't work. We think it works. And we think that when it doesn't work, we have to do it even more. So for example, if you try to go on a diet and you're really good and you say, you know, I'm going to stay on my diet, I'm going to be really good. And so you're giving yourself these pats on the back, and a day, 2 days, you're on the diet, and then finally it's not strong enough and you can't do it anymore and you eat everything in the house. And then the rejection part comes in. Why did I do that? What's wrong with me? Hitting yourself, right? Beating yourself up. And it doesn't have to be a diet. It could be, you know, I'm not going to yell at my kids anymore. And how could I have done that? I'm so bad, right? So this internalized punishment and reward system, it's all going back to the greatest fear of any young mammal. But it doesn't work, because essentially to control somebody by threatening their life is nothing more and nothing less than slavery. And we're not meant to be slaves. We are noble, divine beings, and we're not meant to be slaves. And the response of any slave is to rebel. And so that's called a binge when it comes to diet, or an outbreak or an outburst when it comes to some other area, because we're not meant to be slaves. But these habits of self-control, this use of fear encoded as acceptance and rejection, this is another habit of school. The habit of constantly evaluating yourself. Was I a good boy? Was I a good girl today? And we think that we're going to be kinder to the planet by imposing this even more generally and more intensively, this huge effort to be good. And it doesn't work. So, now we have a part two here. at 3 o'clock. And I'd like part two to, what I would like to set up for part two is that everybody goes out in the next few hours, lunch, conversation, another seminar, one something, okay, and just to observe yourself and see if any of this discussion has brought to light a habit of school that was unconscious in you before and now has come to light, and to watch it operating and just to gather some impressions, because I would like to hear how other people are liberating themselves from these habits, because that'll help me liberate myself from these habits, and we can all help each other. So gather some data, gather some impressions, and we'll meet again at 3 o'clock, and we can share with each other the ways that... Right, this is the theoretical part. Now I want to really get practical. So we'll share with each other how we can actually liberate ourselves and what we've learned from observing ourselves in the next few hours. Okay? So thank you very much. Yeah.
You've been listening to the first half of a seminar conducted by Charles Eisenstein, author of Ascent of Humanity, on de-schooling. He gave the participants a long break for self-examination before the second part of the workshop. We'll take a far shorter break with some music by Ethan Miller and Kate Boverman, then return to the second half of the seminar on de-schooling. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
Wake up in the morning, take a good look around, make a stroll through the trees, take a walk downtown. Into the faces, every shade and stripe, and you're looking at the fruit of the tree, of the tree of life. Bring on the rain, let the water roll down, open up the sky, let the sun roll round, soak it on up, let the fruit grow right. And we're chilling in the shade of the tree of life. Open up the door, take a breath of fresh air, go digging in the dirt, see what you find there. Plant a little seed of the heirloom type, and you're growing new shoots on the tree of life. Bring on the rain, let the water roll down, sky, let the sun roll round, soak it on up, let the fruit grow right. And we're chilling in the shade of the tree of life. We'll be chilling in the garden, planting our seeds, hanging with the neighbors, meeting our needs, growing our freedom instead of growing our strife. Water in the roots of the tree, of the tree of life. Bring on the rain, let the water roll down, open up the sky, let the sun roll round, soak it on up, let the fruit grow right. And we're chilling in the shade of the tree of life.